right. Well, welcome, everybody. It is noon Central Time, which is when we start our call. So welcome to the November Citizens Climate Lobby International Call. In just a moment, I'll be introducing our guest, Dr. Charles Kennell, who we're very, very excited to have on the call. If you're new to the call, what we do on this call is we educate ourselves every month, and then we focus on action. The most important thing is that we stay in action, and that no matter what got done the previous month, we stay focused on what we're doing next month. So after our speaker, we're going to go over what we got done last month and what we're focused on doing this month. And just so if you are new to the call, the solution that we're focused on, because we are 100% focused on solving the problem, not wringing our hands or complaining about it or whining about it, but staying in action towards solving the problem. The solution we're focused on is what I would call the Secretary Schultz solution, which what Secretary Schultz argues for is a steadily rising fee on carbon with all of the money going back to households as a dividend. Now, when we meet with Secretary Schultz, one of the things he always says is the dividend is the best solution because it's the most transparent. And I think when you're dealing with really, really big problems, honesty, integrity, transparency are really important, and Secretary Schultz agrees. Now, there's one other thing I want to point to that Mr. Schultz says when we meet with him. First of all, this is a really, really good listener. And when we're talking, he pays very, very close attention. There's one thing that he jumps in on every time we speak with him, and that is, we talk about that we're working on a bipartisan solution. And what Secretary Schultz says, when we say bipartisan, he always jumps in and says nonpartisan. And I think that distinction is important, that there is a big difference between bipartisan and nonpartisan. And I want to point to one data point as to why I think that's so important. In the last 3 weeks, David Brooks, who identifies himself as a conservative columnist from the New York Times, has pointed to a piece of data that says in 1960s, 5% of Americans cared if their children married people of the same party. In the 1960s, 5% of Americans cared if their children married people of the same political party. Now, 33% of Democrats think it's important that their children marry people of the same party, and 49% of Republicans. And that's just straight out messed up. And I think that it points to that it's not just what we're doing, but the way we're doing that is important. That if people identify themselves based on where they're different than others, it's hard to deal with big problems, and I don't think you can solve big things by being small-minded. So that data point, I think, points to the importance of what we're doing, not only the straightforward solution, but that we're doing it by starting where we find commonality with people, not where we disagree with them. Okay, so let me tell you just a little bit about our speaker today. Dr. Charles Kennell is a member of the United States National Academy of Sciences. He has a bachelor's degree from Harvard and a doctorate in astrophysical science from Princeton. He was the 9th director of Scripps Institution of Oceanography. He was the vice chancellor of marine sciences at the University of California, San Diego from 1998 to 2006. A member and chair of the NASA Advisory Council from 1998 to 2006, and chair of the National Academy of Sciences Space Studies Board. He's had numerous publications that we could ask him to speak to. If we went all the way back to 1966, we could ask him to speak to unstable growth of unducted whistlers propagating at an angle to the geomagnetic field. But I don't think we'll ask Dr. Kennell to speak to that piece, although it might be very interesting to some of us. What we really wanted to do was ask Dr. Kennell to talk about his most recent piece that was published in Nature magazine, which is really one of the most prestigious places that any scientist can get something published, where he questioned if 2 degrees centigrade is the only thing we should be looking at in terms of are we solving this problem. So, Dr. Kennell, first of all, thank you so much for making yourself available. Depending upon time, if there's time for questions, we'll start in Oak Park, Illinois, Northfield, Minnesota, and then Toronto, and then other cities if there's more time. So, Dr. Kennell, good morning and welcome, and thank you for being on the call today.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to and an honor, actually, to speak. I don't think I've ever given a talk before a more diverse or geographically distributed audience, so this is going to be a new experience for me. maybe not for you, but for me. And let me just suggest that I'm in agreement with your overall goals to try to do what we can to reduce our risk of climate change. Now, David Victor, who is a colleague of mine and one of the world's leading policy scholars on the international negotiations about climate and about energy policy, David and I wrote a paper that ended up as an op-ed piece in Nature magazine on October 4th, and it was entitled Ditch the 2-Degree Warming Goal. As you know, that's the central focus of the negotiations that will be coming up in the next few months in Paris, in which the representatives of 190-odd countries are going to try to figure out how they can agree on steps that would allow the world to arrive at 2100 with only 2 degrees warming above since industrial times. And to put that in context, our warming since about 1850 has been 0.85 degrees, and the IPCC thinks we'll go to about 1.3 in the next 20 years or so. So, and we thought that goal is not the appropriate way to set goals for climate management. And so I'm going to try to give you the argument. If I babble on too long, stop me, and this will be sort of a technical policy kind of talk. Let me start. I think, like the rest of you, that the mitigation efforts to reduce the risk of climate change that we are making are wildly insufficient. And many people have said that the risks are piling up at such a rate that actually the goal should be 1.5 degrees. Tighten down, double down on that temperature number. But we think that doubling down on the temperature number as a goal of negotiations, just to make that point, is risky. And David and I come from a school that believes that that while achieving 2 degrees still may be technically feasible, assuming the optimistic deployment rates of energy technologies, we believe that achieving the goal is socially unrealistic. And a very good example will be, I was just at a meeting yesterday in San Diego of community and management leaders, and we were talking about the retrofit of buildings. And if California is going to meet its greenhouse gas commitments, we will have to reduce the energy consumption of every single building in California to 20% of its present level by 2050. And in order to do that, we had thought that new building codes for new building would have to be in place by next year, and that's not going to happen. So failure to achieve a goal is going to further erode the confidence in the international community's ability to deal with it. And David's written a book called Global Warming Gridlock, which you may want to read. And if we just double down on a goal that we think, that David and I think is unfeasible, just to make the point, we think that increases the risk of failure and loss of confidence in the negotiations. This does not mean, in fact, that's the only way to approach climate change, and we believe much more in community action. But in addition, there are a whole bunch of technical problems with the use of setting any goal as the sole measure of our progress in controlling climate change. Everybody's familiar with the term global warming. It's easy to understand. People have gotten used to the idea that if we add carbon dioxide to the atmosphere, the world would get warmer. Everybody believes that. That is the mantra. That is the denialists believe it, and we believe it. So we believe that the temperature is going to go up. And the scientific community uses a vast modeling infrastructure to forecast how climate is expected to change in the future at every place on the Earth. And they get a wildly fluctuating and changing picture of change as it unfolds. It's different at every place on Earth. And yet of all of this very detailed and valuable knowledge, they focus on the one number that only a physicist could love, the global average surface temperature, a number that conveys moreover, that conveys to the public the misleading impression that the world is going to warm up uniformly. They then compare the same models, now applied to the past and the current climate, with a number that is gotten from averaging millions of temperature measurements from land and sea over the entire Earth for a year, the measured global surface temperature. Now, everybody knows that the temperature changes from day to day, hour to hour, season to season, but you boil all of that down, average it all over the Earth, and you get this global surface temperature. Now, this number is dominated by the satellite measurements of the sea surface temperature. And that's simple reason. The oceans cover 70% of the Earth's surface, so they determine their behavior is going to determine the behavior of this measured number. But for the scientists, if the modeling and the measurement numbers agree, it's one sign of scientific success. But other signs will be how all of the distribution of impacts from place to place and so forth, how they turn out. So it's just one sign of scientific success. And our point is that the surface temperature is an imperfect index of a more fundamental quality, quantity, which is the rate that our greenhouse gases are adding energy to the climate system. And it's that energy that invested in storms and extreme events and in the expansion of the ocean for sea level rise, it's that energy that is causing the risks to humans, not the temperature. And more than that, we now know, the IPCC will tell you, that not more than 90% of the energy that we are, by our greenhouse additions to warming, the 90% of that energy ends up hidden below the surface of the ocean, where it will not interact with the atmosphere until it reappears decades and centuries later. So the warming that we put into the ocean, which is 90% of what we're doing, is causing risk for future generations. So that's, but people use the temperature to measure our impact and to measure the risk that our civilization runs from climate change. Now, this is all tied up with the structure of the negotiations. The United States and the many hundreds of countries, more than almost 200 countries, are signatories of the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, which was signed in 1992. And its fundamental objective is, and I'm going to quote, to achieve stabilization of greenhouse gas concentrations, at a level that would prevent, and here are the key words, dangerous anthropogenic interference with the climate system. It's impeccable. We've got to stop piling up greenhouse gases before it gets dangerous. You know, when does it get dangerous? Now, nobody really can forecast how, when, where, and to whom the impacts of climate change are going to become intolerable, or if they will. But intuitively, it seems natural to suppose that if the temperature increases enough, that will certainly happen. So the 2009 Conference of Parties meetings, the annual meetings of the IPCC, the diplomats and all subsequent meetings, the diplomats and the policymakers declared that dangerous anthropogenic interference could be avoided if the temperature increase since pre-industrial times could be held to 2 degrees. It was kind of an arbitrary number. There wasn't much science behind it, but it did express the fact, the intuitive fact, that if the temperature goes up enough, so will the risks. But the key issue is that since it is the energy that is added to the climate system that creates risks for societies and ecologies, the temperature concept only indirectly addresses the UNFCCC objective. More than that, it's a dangerously thin, we think it's a dangerously thin indicator of dangerous anthropogenic interference. Now, by itself, if we looked only at temperature, and if we looked at the progress of temperature as a sign of safety or risk, it's a dangerous thing to do. Now, there are plenty of other complicated, nonlinear, multiple systems, multiply connected systems, like the economy or the human body. And in all of these cases, policymakers don't look at one index. We don't consider only the GDP in the economy. We don't only, everybody knows that that you can run a temperature, it's a bad thing in the human body, but there's plenty of illnesses that are dangerous without your running a temperature. So we've, in the areas of finance and in the areas of medicine, we've gotten used to what you'd call a basket of indicators or a basket of vital signs. And so you really should be looking not only at temperature, but you should be looking at the impacts on ecologies, on human health, all of the things that people are talking about as risks. You should try to find indicators of those risks and judge your progress against those. And this is where we think, and I'll explain to you in a minute why our most recent experience tells us, reveals some of the danger of just looking only at temperature. Now, there's also a practical reason for the negotiations. The 2-degree goal or any temperature goal does not actually tell governments to do what to do. And this is because of the imperfections in the models. The climate models cannot go backwards from some future temperature increase tomorrow back to the emission reductions you need today. Looking at it the other way, if you had a given emission reduction today that you had all agreed to, the best the models can do is a spread of temperature outcomes that might itself be saying that, well, if we do this, the most probable outcome will lie between 1 and 3 degrees. So think of the impact. So there's already a risk just in the uncertainty of the models that you won't achieve that goal. And it's not very practical anyhow because it doesn't say, it doesn't commit people to specific actions. So we think it's much more practical in politics for governments to monitor the progress on specific detailed goals for each human contributor to climate change, all the greenhouse gases. You can make a lot of progress in the short term looking at other things like black carbon, and you can make a lot of progress looking and working in controlling methane. You should look at the progress that you make in controlling carbon in the short term. You should monitor deforestation, as we are doing, but you should give credit in the negotiations for these. And there will be in the future other measures that reduce climate risk. A country, for example, that decides to paint its roofs white will improve the climate outcome. So we need a set of specific actionable goals, not an enchanting but non-specific vision like 2 degrees. And in this regard, the Millennium Development Goals that were developed for societies and ecologies in the year 2000 are much more specific. So now, the other part of it is that I have separately and been concerned with what the behavior of the climate during the last 16 years has been telling us about temperature as an index of societal and ecological risk. And it turns out that our climate system has been going through a regime change from the steady growth in global surface temperature that prevailed between 75 and 98 and a slower growth following 1998. And this period is, the period that we're in, the last 16 years, has been called picturesquely and somewhat inaccurately, a hiatus in warming. And it is one of the principal popular arguments against action on climate. And why take expensive action if the temperature is no longer increasing? Okay. But if you examine the behavior of the world's climate during this period of time, it has been a period in which the humans, we are adding energy to the climate system at if anything, at a faster rate. But this energy was sent deeper into the oceans. And it's not appear at the surface of the ocean and does not contribute as much as in the past to the contribution to the measured global temperature computation. So, and in addition, it turns out that for those of us who live in the Western North America, we have been in an exceptionally long La Nina phase of the Pacific Ocean when it itself is cool. But we are getting, and usually the changes between La Nina and El Nino occur every 4 to 5 years, and we've had a 16-year La Nina, which means that the climate characteristics of a La Nina phase have persisted for a long time, and they are beginning to become troublesome to society. The most obvious example of that, for those of us who live in California, has been the very long drought since the El Nino of 1998. So what we have is a situation in which the temperature is growing slowly, continuing to do that, but very slowly. But the risks have continued to pile up. The risks to future generations are being buried as we speak in the deeper ocean, and the risks to present generations are there due to the persistence of climate patterns that, as they continue, become more and more difficult for our society. And imagine, suppose this state should persist for another 20, 30 years and the temperature remained the same. Okay? The planet actually might stay below 1.5 degrees if this cycle continues for that long. But we would still be experiencing significant impacts and still be piling risks through the oceans on future generations. And those people that don't want to see action on climate change would repeat over and over again in various decision arenas, the temperature hasn't grown. What are we worried about? There's no urgency. Now, the most important aspect of this urgency is that the key decisions that are going to be taken in the coming years are not only on reducing greenhouse gases, which is a global way of reducing the risk for everybody, but now every community has to consider what it is going to do because the climate is going to be changing. And they need to understand their issues. And if somebody comes into a city council and says, hey, wait a minute, you know, the temperature hasn't gone up that much, we don't have to worry about that. This year, let's do something else, you'll find that argument very persuasive. It's easy to put off difficult decisions. And so if we, returning back to the basic theme, if the public and we had been conditioned to looking to a whole bunch of indices, the way we do in medicine or the way we do in the economy, then we would have had a better way of conveying the risks that we are running. So that was the basic thrust of this paper. We've gotten an awful lot of criticism from people who said, you know, the best thing going was the simplicity of the 2-degree risk, 2-degree concept. Everybody could understand it, and there's momentum going in the negotiations, and our ideas are getting in the way. And I think that's the main criticism, that the train is leaving the station, and we're trying to call it back. So that's That's, I think, the gist of that talk. Have I used? I probably used more than my 15 minutes. So.
You know what? We do have. We have five more minutes of the educational part of this call. So, Dr. Kendall, let me see if I can sneak a couple of questions in here real quick. And let me just say, you know, we had some people who were worried about the controversy of the paper. But one thing I hope we're never afraid of as an organization is, first of all, you know, anything published in Nature, that's one of the most prestigious scientific journals people can publish in. And certainly, we can never be afraid of an esteemed scientist's opinion. The day we're afraid of that and that we become dogmatic, I think we lose our value to dealing with the problem. So we're really, really glad to be honored. Let me just see if we can sneak in at least. Oak Park, Illinois was the first group that asked for a question. David, if you could star six your phone and let me know if there's somebody there in Oak Park that wanted a question, hopefully we can get one, possibly two questions in the next 5 minutes. Is someone there, David? Okay, well, let's try.
Can you hear me, Mark?
Yep. Yeah. Okay, I can now, David. Go ahead.
Okay, I'm sorry. Thank you, Dr. Kendall, for your presentation this morning, and I'd also like to thank you and Dr. Victor for writing that Nature comment piece. I think that many of the critics have kind of missed a point that should be obvious simply by virtue of the fact that the two of you, a climate scientist and a political scientist, co-wrote the article. And that point being that the intensely political nature of any discussion about climate, particularly here in the United States, and I think it's particularly relevant for this audience whose stated mission, after all, is to, quote, create the political will for a stable climate, unquote. And in that context, I'd like to ask you if you could elaborate a bit on your suggestion that we begin to track the total area during the year in which conditions stray by 3 standard deviations from the local and seasonal mean. You make that suggestion toward the end of your piece, referencing a James Hansen article that raises this possibility. And particularly, I'd particularly like to hear your thoughts about how that can help us communicate the nexus of the climate and the politics here. Thank you very much.
That may be more, I may rely on you guys for figuring out how to explain it. But Jim Hansen, as you know, for years has been arguing that extreme events are going to increase in space and time. And he's been criticized because there wasn't any reliable measure. And I think finally he attacked and solved this problem. And it was because of the tremendous density now that we do have of temperature measurements across the surface of the Earth. And he began to look at heat waves, where there was a lot of spatial data that was available. And so all he did was ask, take a huge database and ask, what is the area over which the temperature exceeds the seasonal and local average by 3 standard deviations, factor 10. And so when was the temperature exceedingly high? And over how large an area did that occur? And then try to compute the area over a year that would happen, and then compare years and the global area. And he found that measure of risk, the area over which there have been serious heat waves, has increased more or less from the beginning of this millennium at the year 2000 to the present significantly. And so this is... And right now you can only do it for temperature because of the reliability of the data. You might in the future be able to do it for big storms and the like. And the question is, that's a technical issue about being able to do it. But I do think that the key point is that for the first time, there's actually quantitative measures of that kind of extreme event that they have, in fact, been increasing over time.
Great. Dr. Kendall, I know that the group would love to just spend the other half of the call that we have to get some other things just asking more questions. This has been very enlightening and useful, and we're extremely grateful that you could make yourself available. You're more than welcome to stick around for the second part of the call, but if you have other things to do, we certainly understand it. But
I'll stick around for a while, and I apologize for rambling on.
Oh, no, that was fantastic. That was fantastic. I don't think any of us would call any of that rambling. Thank you, sir. Great. Okay, everybody. So what's going to happen is in just a moment, I want to go through some of the results since last month's call. So I'm going to ask Amy Bennett to come on in just a second. One of the things that we'll do every month that won't happen during the call but will happen in your group after is the laser talk. So one of the things that became obvious from this year's conference, from seeing over 507 offices, the issue that was brought up most consistently by congressional offices was the border. So last month and this month, we had laser talks that relate to dealing with the border. The one that this month emphasizes the many pricing mechanisms that are in place, either carbon tax or cap and trade throughout the world. You'll notice that Dr. Richter wrote his laser talk very carefully. He talks about 40 pricing mechanisms, because if you go to the links and you actually add them up, you'll see that more than 40, and that's because in some cases countries had both a cap and trade and a carbon tax, and he tried to only count everything once. But I think that's a real important point also, because some people say, well, you'll never price carbon, but there's already 40 pricing mechanisms in place, so that's just crazy. What you should tell people when they say it'll never happen is it's already happening. It's just a matter of what type of leadership we're going to take here and in Canada on the issue. Okay, Amy Bennett, are you there?
Yes, Mark, can you hear me?
Yes, yes, I can. And so we are getting close on a couple of thresholds that could be pretty exciting in some of the activities people are generating. And what are those?
Well, it's November, and so I'm going to give you year-to-date figures, Mark. We have 925 meetings with members of Congress and Parliament year-to-date. So with a push, we can get to 1,000. We just have 75 to go, and with the activity scheduled for November, we should reach that possibly by December. We have 1,789 letters to the editor. So there's only 211 to get to 2,000. And with all of the articles in the newspaper about the upcoming elections, we have an opportunity to do that. We also have seven new groups that I wanted to tell you about. We have Fairbanks, Alaska. Big thanks to George Denart, CCO Anchorage group leader, who picked up the training when the Skype connection failed. And now we have a group in Fairbanks under the leadership of Andrew McDonald. We have two new groups in Georgia, North Atlanta, and Gwinnett County. The Atlanta metro region has 6.1 million people, and that spreads out over the size of the state of Massachusetts. Now we have a total of three groups around Atlanta. Jeff Jocelyn launched our North Atlanta group, and co-leaders Terry Welsher and Bert Schuster lead the Gwinnett County group in the Northeast. Now we've got Minnesota. Red Wing, Minnesota now, and that is Martha Harris, Donna Lundberg, and Bill Michener, who started our newest Minnesota group there. Cleveland, Ohio jumps in with both feet as Paul Sherlock hosted the workshop in his home while he was away. His good friend Ann Caruso stepped up to the plate to co-lead the group. Now, Billings, Montana is the next group, and for that group start, there was a Billings Gazette newspaper and KTVQ that covered the launch of our Billings group with photos and a TV camera. And lastly, Ashfield, Massachusetts. Richard Tree hosted this launch just last week, and 15 folks attended, with two of them already having thoughts to start their own CCL chapters. So that's it for the figures, Mark.
Great. And so, Amy, how many letters to the editor do we have to get to hit 2,000?
That would be 211 more.
Okay, and didn't they say that of things that would never be done, no one would ever break the 4-minute mile, no one would ever go on the moon, and no group would ever get 2,000 letters to the editor on the issue of solving global warming? And do I have that correct, that those were the three things?
Yes, I've heard that multiple times.
All right, and I think that there's a huge opportunity, everybody, this month, not only with the elections, because we'll get a chance to talk about what did or didn't happen next Tuesday, but also the IPCC. We will have a strong idea of what's happening on that this Sunday. So there should be a huge opportunity. It would be really fun to get that over the line between U.S. and Canadian groups in the month of November, and then see whatever happens in December after that. Okay, I want to bring Alex Amonette on for just a moment, because I think, you know, everybody who's been on this call for a while knows that there is a constant innovation, that we started with a model. We borrowed a model from results, because results prove that if you organize people, gave people an effective structure, you could get really interesting things done with Congress. But then we've innovated off that, and the innovation has always come from some volunteer in the field. So we have a very, very strong agricultural team inside of CCL. We know ag that is going to be an issue in almost every single state. so the Ag Committee's been working hard on solutions as it relates to ag. But Alex is kind of taking it to another step now. So, Alex from our Tri-City Washington group, are you there?
Yes, good morning. Can you hear me?
Good morning, Alex. Yes, I can. So tell us what you're doing up there with farming there in Washington.
Okie doke. So I live in eastern Washington state, and it's dominated by wheat, lentils, potatoes, vineyards, and orchards. And our chapter formed a year ago and decided if we could get endorsements for the fee and dividend from these big ag sectors, we could take these endorsements to our members of Congress. And this we decided is crucial because it's the big money and influence in our district. So Ellie had suggested that we reach out to farm bureaus. And 7 months ago, I put aside my prejudices about some farming practices and emailed the CEO of the State Farm Bureau. And I asked him if there was someone with whom I could discuss climate change matters. He asked me specifically what I wanted to know, and I said three things. One, CCL highly respects the Farm Bureau. Two, we've met with a member of their Washington, D.C. office last summer. And three, we have a carbon fee and dividend legislative proposal that will help us reduce the carbon dioxide emissions without government regulations or growing the government. So he asked a staff representative to follow up with me, and I've had half a dozen conversations with that staff rep and many emails. So we've shared with the rep the National Climate Assessment and Dr. Jim Hansen and his colleagues' article about assessing dangerous climate change. And at Ellie's suggestion, and with the help from the Seattle chapter, we also linked him up with a retired climate scientist to help him understand the science, because the Bureau doesn't see global warming as a problem now. Two calls ago, the rep asked us to answer four questions related to human versus natural variability and how much our fee and dividend will help reduce temperatures and reduce emissions. And he said, if you can answer these four questions in just two pages, it would really help him, quote unquote, turn the ship around. So we did that two-pager. In our last phone call, it was about a month ago, he said he really appreciated our hard work on it. He said he really appreciates Citizens Climate Lobby and that we're doing something on a national level makes sense to him. He suggested that we meet with him and the board, we suggested that we meet with him and his board, and he said he would talk with the CEO about that. And he knows that we want the Farm Bureau's endorsement. So I'm very hopeful that we'll meet soon. That's it.
Okay, that's fantastic work, Alex. And let me tell you how that translates out to everybody. You know, we have a liaison, so a point of contact for almost every congressional office in both the House and Senate. We're working on in Parliament in Canada also. One of the things that Alex has started and we're now going to work on is creating a relationship, a liaison to every Farm Bureau. The Farm Bureau is essentially the Republican-based organization that represents ag in each state. And agriculture is crucial to our success. So having a point of contact, having people we work with, having a relationship with them is going to be absolutely essential. Alex, thanks for blazing a brilliant trail there. Okay, I want to go over a couple of other actions since last month. I want to go over the U.S. and Canadian actions. And then I have one last thing that's really important, so do not drop off the call early. The last 2 minutes of the call is really, really crucial. Okay, so the person who founded our group in Arkansas, Shelley and Robert did, they gave a presentation at St. Scholastica, a convent for retired nuns, beautiful women devoting their lives to social justice. Shelley says in her note, I feel so good every time I go there. We had dinner with them. Robert had made this invitation for the nuns to send to our members of Congress, inviting them to the REMI Forum with Scott Nystrom on November 19th and 20th. 33 nuns took three requests that they promised that they would then send to members of Congress. So 33 nuns at the convent said they would send requests to members of Congress asking them to attend the REMI briefings that we're having in November in Washington, D.C. She said, we also included Mina Clemens as the third presenter. She's a new speaker, very nervous, but had attended the climate march and was full of passion. The nuns were encouraging to her. She tried to find words. She's Mexican and wants to be a bridge to speak about climate change to the Hispanic community. We're immensely pleased she joined us. I just thought that that's fantastic to know that some of the things people are doing out there. Okay, a couple of highlights on international. Niels Petermann, who's heading up CCL Germany, met with one of his members of parliament. I just want you to know the same model of creating a relationship of partnership is working. He was lamenting with his conservative member of parliament that Chancellor Merkel had not gone to the UN climate summit, and his member of parliament immediately pulled out his phone, scrolled through his email, and said, yeah, here's my email that I sent to the chancellor saying the exact same thing. Lars in Sweden just helped CCL Sweden launch a new group in Gothenburg and then volunteered to be the interim leader while the group figures out who will lead. This requires Lars to travel a significant distance at least once a month to be at the meetings. When Joe asked Lars on the CCL Europe call what made him decide to do it, he said to Joe, it's a strong group. I think they'll be an effective group. This had to be done to support them, so I'm doing it. Lars, you are an inspiration to all of us. In Australia, Lauren Hutchinson met with the environmental minister since last month's call. Our most recent volunteer, David Miller, was actually able to get into the IPCC meetings in Europe because we sent a letter from CCL asking him to do so. He noticed that people weren't talking about temperature, so we actually asked the chair to focus on one policy, which we have. And the other is what he called our DNA. And I believe our DNA is defined by this letter, which is just a basic expression of human generosity and an attempt to be as generous with ourselves, our time, and our money as we can possibly be. So, Peter, again, thank you for this extraordinary letter. All of you, thank you for the remarkable things that you've done last month and things you'll do this month. We'll talk to you all in exactly a month from now for the December call. I'm going to unmute the line so you can say goodbye, everybody. Thank you, and again, thank you, Dr. Kennel. Hold on.